We will come to order. We have a quorum. Members, if you look at your packet, you'll find a memo from Lisa Larson regarding her testimony last week, revising the statewide academic standards and related benchmark tests. These are the cheat sheets, the official cheat sheets. So here they are. Members, this coming Thursday, we'll have our meeting at 8 o'clock as scheduled. We'll be going through the first of a couple discussions regarding the state academic standards and to be thinking about what our role is in terms of ownership of both the content of those standards, the rigor of them, as well as process, ongoing process issues related to the development of those standards. Next Tuesday, we're not going to have our 8 o'clock Tuesday morning meeting. That's the good news. We're going to start at 7, Representative Abel. Instead, we're scheduling a meeting out in a community setting in North Minneapolis, along with Representative Greiling's K-12 Finance Committee. Both committees will be holding a hearing there. Our intent is to hear directly from community members. We're working awfully hard to make sure that we have a lot of diverse perspectives, and we'll do a little bit of that today, hearing from superintendents from Greater Minnesota as well as suburban communities. But we felt it was really important to get into a highly populated inner city diverse community to hear from them on the themes that we've been talking about for the last week and a half. So that'll be next Tuesday, and actually I'm not sure what time, is that 7? 7 o'clock? 7 p.m. here. We will be arranging for transportation from here. So please be in contact with our committee administrator, Christina Gossick, regarding your transportation needs. If for whatever reason you can't make the meeting, of course, I do encourage you to attend, but if you can't, please let us know as well. Okay, very good. I guess we need to adopt minutes here. We have minutes from January 18th. Representative Erickson, would you be so kind as to move our minutes from...
Mr. Chair, I do move the minutes. I did look them over, and hopefully I didn't miss anything, so I'll move approval.
Super. Representative Erickson moves approval of the January 18th meeting. I'm sorry, did I say the wrong date? January 18th?
18th is correct.
Okay. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Motion is approved. Members, we are going to hear from a couple of members here because we're going to get around the table on this discussion. As you know, the other education committees have been doing this as well, and we're almost toward the end. We're the biggest committee, so it's taking us a little bit longer. And then we're going to get into our major discussion for today. And I should have been giving heads up, but Representative Haas, I'm going to ask you to share.
District 14B, which is pretty much smack dab in the middle of the state. I should note that I come from the largest school district in the state of Minnesota, but moved up to St. Joseph about 10 years ago. I represent the school districts of St. Cloud, Avon Albany, Ricori, Kimball, Painesville, and Eden Valley. And Eden Valley Watkins, as we'll find out, some of the best superintendents come out of Eden Valley Watkins. We have great test scores, and it's a model school for the state of Minnesota. We're also working on a mercury cleanup, which has made some statewide news. Represent also Ricori, in which many people know that there have been some challenges in that community in the past few years. I'm really excited to be on this committee, especially hopefully offering a rural perspective and making sure that our policies not only benefit certain schools but all of our schools throughout Minnesota. So I appreciate the opportunity and hope that we have a productive session.
Super. Thank you, Representative Hosh. Who did I send? Oh, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I've been looking forward to this little presentation. In the beginning, I was up to my sophomore year in high school, and
you
I thought
have 45 seconds left.
I've been a teacher for 35 years at New London Spicer. Resigned on June 2nd of this year, 7th grade American history. Some will appreciate, I said this before, that they did accept my resignation with regrets. They regretted I didn't do it sooner. But I represent 18B, which is Meeker County, most of Meeker County, and six townships in Wright County, some of the cities. Litchfield is the largest city in the district. They have a particular problem that I think several of our districts share, dealing with special education and reimbursement rates that I would like to talk more about later. I also represent Dassel Procato, Howard Lake, Waverly, Winstead, with a major concern with open enrollment, as does ACGC, Atwater Cosmos, Grove City. They are in statutory operating debt to $300,000, and they lose $700,000 in open enrollment each year. I, too, represent the Eden Valley-Watkins District. The county line goes right through the middle of Eden Valley. Representative Hosh liked to joke that he represents the side of town as a church, and I have the strip club. Now, the major concern there, of course, is the with the mercury spill. The strip club is closed, by the way, but the mercury spill is a problem that we'll be talking more about later on. I have concerns with, in general terms, with school safety, equity funding, with special ed funding, open enrollment. I have concerns with FIED legislation as well, and look forward to working with the members of this committee to do good things for education in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. I'm going to ask our four presenters to come forward. Charlie Kite, Minnesota Association of School Administrators, Dr. Roger Giroux, I hope I said that right, superintendent of the smallest school district in the state. Kathy Leadham, superintendent from Wilmer, and Kent Patel, executive director of the consortium for post-secondary academic success, University of Minnesota. Members, today it's my hope that we'll have a good conversation regarding some big picture issues that have been framed up for us through 2 years of efforts on behalf of I think a couple of dozen superintendents from all points of the state that resulted in a product entitled Minnesota's Promise, World-Class Schools, World-Class State. It is the intention of these superintendents to frame up for our state a big core challenge regarding the need for our state to really focus on having all students succeed in a high skill hyper competitive global information age, right off the website, Mr. Kate. I thought as I saw the presentation, some of us were there at the university when they made their first public presentation this fall. And I thought as I listened to the presentation and then visited the document and visited the website that you all have done some terrific work in offering some important frameworks for us to think about and to factor into our policy deliberations as we strive mightily to ensure that our K-12 public school system is not only a high-quality system, but one that really produces what our society needs in an incredibly rapidly changing economic and social and demographic environment. And so I thought it'd be really helpful for this committee early on in its existence in this legislative session to hear from you and to think about what those big sort of touchstones would be as we move forward with very distinct policy directions. It's my hope that as we take up policy bills, and we'll be doing that pretty shortly because they're starting to come, that we have a couple of powerful references from which to make intelligent decisions. So with that, Mr. Kite, I'm going to let you run the show. I think our goal is to have you do a presentation of about 30 to 45 minutes or so, and hopefully that'll then leave enough, a lot of time for good questions from the members. Let us know if you want, how you prefer to do this, if you want members to ask questions during your presentation. But why don't you identify yourself for the record, and welcome to the committee.
Good morning. I'm Charlie Kite. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. And just by opening comments, I was glad to see that there are two distinguished representatives here that actually have Eden Valley Watkins in their districts. I'll point out to you that many years ago, I actually was mayor of Eden Valley, and then later was the superintendent of schools for 8 years. And I'm quite convinced, Representative Hosh, that my slightly receding hairline had something to do with mercury floating around that school. So if you decide to redress that problem, you know, include me in maybe the redress. Minnesota Promise. Let me just give you a little bit of background on how this came to be. A couple of years ago, then Superintendent of Schools Pat Harvey from St. Paul and I had a conversation, and it turned out that Dr. Harvey was also sitting on the board of the Minneapolis Foundation. And somehow in that conversation, we decided that we should bring about 25 prominent school superintendents from around the state together to have a place where we could simply discuss some of the issues around education and see. We didn't really have a plan to issue a paper. We just wanted to come together and see where there were some common grounds, a place where people could talk. The Minneapolis Foundation offered us their meeting room in downtown Minneapolis, and we began these conversations. And as these conversations began, we started to come to recognize that one of the issues in Minnesota was that we were going, all well-intentioned, but we were going in 100 different directions, and there really wasn't a common vision about what we should be doing with education. And as a result of that, we decided that we would come together and write this paper. We had wonderful support from the University of Minnesota. President Bob Brunix became interested. He lent us staff. He lent us support. I think we even met over at Kauffman Union a time or two. And the result of all this is that we put this paper together. We had backing also from the Robbins Kaplan and Miller and Cerisi Foundation, as we had to do the printing and the writing and all that. So that brings us here today. We have two of the superintendents that worked on this project are here, Roger Giroux from Anoka and Kathy Leadham from Wilmer, and also Ken Patel, who at the time when we originally started, I don't know his official title, but I always consider him to be the strategic planner, kind of behind the scenes in the St. Paul Public Schools, figuring out how to have that district really move forward. And Kent now works at the University of Minnesota, but he was the person who actually put the pen to paper in the first drafts of this report. So that's how we came to be here today. We were going to show you a PowerPoint, but I understand the machine is flickering a little bit. Earlier I tried to convince Dr. Giroux to stand behind the screen like with little bunny ears and kind of do a shadow puppet thing, but he didn't seem like he wanted to go there. So we are just going to present to you. You have a PowerPoint in front of you. You kind of follow it where it seems to be appropriate. So at this point, I'd like to ask Dr. Giroux to present.
Welcome, Dr. Giroux, to our committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Roger Giroux. I'm superintendent of the Anoka Hennepin Schools. We serve 41,000 students in the northern suburbs of Minneapolis, and I'm a resident of Champlin, Minnesota. I haven't testified that much since I became superintendent, but I was thinking this morning, my first time doing this is almost 36 years ago, and it hasn't seemed to have stopped since. And you know, that actually has some meaning to what I'm about to do. I actually get to do the preface for this discussion and sort of set the preamble to it. And it is good. It's good to have what I hope is an opportunity to talk about where we're heading with education in Minnesota without being all that positional. It's a chance to actually think out loud and allow those thoughts to be challenged and walk our way through it. And think a bit about where we are headed as a community of people concerned with the education of our children. The group that Charlie spoke about, and Kathy Liederman a few minutes will go to the specifics of this report, but the group that Charlie had spoke about before brought a great many experiences to that table, but I want to mention one that kind of leans on this as well. There were several of us who had the opportunity as well to, within recent time, to visit China. And that adds a certain edge to the conversation that we have about the urgency of what we're talking about for Minnesota's children and for our nation. Let me go to the heart of it. When we look at all that we're doing, one of the pieces that we seem to see in the successful endeavors of this life is focus and articulation and direction. But the randomness for those successful units is really limited. And that as we get into the discussion of where we're headed with Minnesota education, the theme that we're striking is the idea that indeed that common ground and that common focus is essential if we're going to succeed in ensuring that our children are full participants in all that this world has to offer. I'm going to go through this in a couple different ways, and some of you who have been at the Humphrey Institute have heard this before, but allow me that privilege for just a moment, Mr. Chairman. You know, when I first got this job, I had an extraordinary invitation from Microsoft, and that was to go out and meet with the top leadership of the Microsoft Corporation. And so for 3 days, they did this twice. I did this 2 years in a row. The 3 days, they let us meet with their top people, including Gates. There were about 15 of us in the group. Okay. So when you come away from there, you're talked about the guy who's not only saying a lot about education right now, but back then was saying an awful lot about how we are going to live in the future. We talked to them, and they had, there are two things that are really obvious, really obvious. One was that they are focused. There wasn't any misunderstanding of where they were headed with the mission of their organization or the tasks they were going to accomplish to get that done. And the second piece, and this came from Gates as we were talking about American education, and he said at that time, you know, I'm in the world to compete for the best talent there is. I'm absolutely looking for brains. That's the stuff that makes the company go. Everything else is kind of secondary, and we will search throughout every place to be most competitive in securing the best possible for this organization called Microsoft. And he says, and the thing that we say to you, and we were 15 superintendents, is that more often than not, and this is 12 years ago, we are looking at India. More often than not, we're looking at the Pacific Rim. More often than not, we're looking even to China, and more often than not, you'll even see us outsourcing to Ireland. Because all of them have developed a focus for their work and for their activity that meets our needs, and that's where we're getting the most competitive people. And he says, and that's a concern, not because I won't find what I need just by looking and I won't compete successfully, but that's a concern because I don't see our nation as much in that mix as I used to. Okay, so we pulled away from that, and I must add, I learned a lot of lessons on management in talking to these folks as well. But as we went through the rest of the business of visiting China, and you saw an extraordinarily focused group of people, I don't know that I would advise or advance all that to you, but I'm sure you've heard it before. But we visited their classrooms. We had a chance to see 70 in a classroom. We had a chance to see 14 in a classroom. We had the chance to see the schools that were common across the streets of Xi'an and the common schools, and we had a chance to see the absolutely best and the brightest and their best of their schools. And the one thing that you came away with is they weren't misunderstanding at all what they were trying to accomplish. And, of course, with their form of government and society and communication, they eliminate a great deal of the discussion. So they and then when they make a mistake, it's big. It just goes on forever. And I'll repeat this. I've heard it again. They claim that they have more people speaking English in China than we have speaking English in the United States because they see that as their national second language. And they are all bent on teaching science and math, and they're going to teach it in two languages. when we get to the, you know, the bottom of what we did as superintendents, there are a couple of principles that really came to light. Minnesota values education. I've been in the state close to 40 years, and this is the source of my education, bachelor's on up, and I must tell you that Minnesota has as a basic part of its heritage and its culture reliance on what it does with its schools and its children to accomplish its goals and objectives. 30-some years ago, we were trying to figure out what was happening with state assessment results and attitudes, and we did a survey of attitudes of students in Minnesota. And we were looking for that key that changed poverty into an element that discouraged achievement. You know, when you got into different parts of Minnesota, regardless of what the economic level was, the values stayed the same. And so the values that were supporting the educational systems in much of the state were constant and consistent, independent of what was happening with the economy and with the heritage of folks. You could see that permeating everything we believed. And I still believe that that's, in the heart of hearts, the hallmark of what we want to do in this state is based on what we want to do with our children. In a very real sense, we have to organize ourselves, and we're talking to ourselves as superintendents, as well as citizens and parents, and hopefully we're talking to all the other audience. We have to organize ourselves into a common ground that allows us to still discuss the differences of our opinion, but maintain a common focus of what it is we're trying to accomplish and get that done for the children. Because if we don't, we're going to dissipate our resources, and we're going to not meet the needs those kids are going to have as they become adults and have to compete in that new world, that new society. We need a vision that unifies the work of each school and all schools at all levels of learning, pre-K through the PhD and beyond. It's important that we talk to the University of Minnesota, Grunix, and Chancellor McCormick, and to Minsky, and that we talk to our two-year institutions and we talk to our four-year institutions. It's critical that we understand that we talk to our parents about what that vision is and what we're trying to accomplish. I'm watching my time, Mr. Chairman. Let me make a personal
note. You're doing fine, Superintendent Jerome.
You know, it's difficult to do this without a personal reflection, and I'm going to ask you to bear with me for a moment. I've told this story before. I'll tell it again. I depended on my parents and my family for the motivation and the direction to know what it is we valued and what we're going to accomplish. And there were times when they had a difficult time coming up with the bucks to provide the education that they wanted for their children. And I can remember a time when my brother, who was 11 years older than I am, was in college, and he had decided he was going to switch to a professional school. And they had struggled to get the money to get him through that first 3 years, and now he's going to switch, and we thought, okay. Only to find out the scholarship didn't follow. So he lost the thing, and I remember I slept on a daybed in a three-flat in Chicago. I slept on a daybed in the dining room, and I could hear my mother and father in the kitchen talking. And I'm about 11 years old. And he's struggling with the idea that his firstborn, that he's going to lose it. He's not going to make it. So he invests. He talks to my mother. He says, I got to talk to him. I got to go down and talk to him. And she says, I don't know how to do it. So they dress him up. You know, he's a working man, and he gets the suit out that he hasn't worn for ages, and I still remember that, you know, just remember pressing the shirt and your coat didn't fit, didn't match the trousers, didn't matter. He's going down to talk to them. And he goes downtown Chicago, and he doesn't have an appointment, and they're meeting, and they're not sure what to do with him. And they explain that when you switch to a professional school, the scholarship doesn't hold. And he tries to explain that he's got to have it. And, you know, I came home, and they're sitting at the table, and I'm laying on the bed, and I'm hearing him telling them that he's, you know, he found that to be a fairly humiliating experience. But he had no doubt about what it is he had to accomplish. You know, he had no doubt about what it was. Now, I'm laying there, and I'm hearing him talk about the agony of this. Now, they got that all done. And I don't know how. I can't remember how that all happened. But I'll tell you that laying there and listening to him, I understood what the focus was. I understood what my family valued. I understood what they wanted to accomplish. It was very clear to me. You know, I tell you that because, you see, Minnesota has to do that too. For our children, we have to find a way to make sure they understand what we value and what we want and how we expect it. And we need to help every parent out there communicate that same business. And so if I had to express this to you in some form of from my soul rather than my intellect, I would tell you that it's a commitment to motivate and help and cause the children of this state and their parents to believe, to hope, to have the expectation, and see the path.
not get confused, not get misguided, but see the path of what it is we can do for them and make it as clear as we can, and give them consistency and permanence to that. We need a vision that transcends economic and political change. We need a vision that generates belief and reliance on learning. We need a driving force to become the world's best in learning and face the changing and ever more competitive world. We need a vision that assures that every parent, that their child is included in the vision, and that empowers every parent to make their children believers in that kid's ability to learn. And, of course, we need to give them many, many paths to that. And then let me make a reflection on No Child Left Behind. You're going to, as you feel and sense and as you're creating as legislators and as the governor created in this message, we have this tremendous need to move the top. We're addressing the level of excellence at the top. And I remind you that we made a commitment 5-7 years ago, however it happened, to leave no child behind. But when we did that, we were talking about the achievement gap closer to the bottom. And if we have a responsibility, it is to ensure that as we reach to the top, we don't go for the low-hanging fruit. It is easiest to move the advantaged middle-class white kid who's already got a leg up into the next level of achievement and then start meeting our competitive needs. But we also have a responsibility to make sure we don't leave any child behind when we reach for the top, which means that gaps that appear there have to be closed as well. And how much more challenging that's going to be in many respects, especially when Pat Harvey reminded me of this, when you're talking about generations of citizens who may have been denied for generations, and we ask them to come back and to believe, and we need to show the path and the way. I truly think that there is a challenge that we have not had before, have not recognized before, and the way the world is changing. I don't know that there are instant answers for all that, but as we go about the business of discussing some very concrete suggestions and principles of what we believe in as superintendents, I'll tell you that that's coupled with the belief that this nation will continue to lead, because we want to build a better society, not just succeed economically. But we want to build a better place for mankind. And if it's going to be this nation, then why would it not be Minnesota? My Lord, there are only 50 states in the union, and I've never heard us ever say, well, we'll be fine, we'll let you putt first and see how it goes. There is a point where you actually say, no, it is Minnesota, and we'll do what we can for that. Kathy Leedham is going to take us through, if I may tell you, Kathy Leedham is going to take us through the basic points and parts of what the superintendent suggested, some building blocks for this. And Kathy, thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent Jerome. Thank you for centering us appropriately so in focusing us on notions of hope and expectation and motivation. And I think when you spoke, I think all of us have our own stories and our own journeys that match up very closely with what you framed up for us here today. Thank you. Superintendent Leedham, welcome.
Yes, Representative Mariani and members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to be here. As you mentioned, my name is Kathy Leedham, Superintendent for the Willmar Public Schools, and very pleased to have been a part of the symposium atmosphere that brought about the Minnesota's Promise document. Roger did a wonderful job in setting the stage and in really framing for you the fact that we really believe that we need a coherent vision for education that extends from the Capitol to the classroom. And we'd like to share with you the traits that we've identified, that is 25 superintendents coming together, identifying 8 traits that we think need to be essential ingredients in a vision for education in the state of Minnesota. We have not written or designed a vision. We have gathered these points of agreement together, and now we are poised to be a part of taking the next step, which will, we hope, truly bring about a coherent and comprehensive vision for education in the state of Minnesota. So if you would please, I'll work from the PowerPoint document that you have in front of you. And as we just mentioned, we're talking about a common and a coherent vision for all of public education in the state of Minnesota. And most importantly, the fact that it would be a vision or a strategic plan that we could make commitment to over a long period of time. One of the frustrations that we feel as superintendents is the fact that We have lots of great initiatives that sort of come and go, but there isn't a long-range plan, a 6 or 7 year plan, if you will, that we can all locally develop strategies that could help to accomplish. So that's what we're really striving for here, a comprehensive plan on behalf of our children. Why do we want to have coherence from the capital to the classroom? Well, of course, first and foremost is the whole concept of raising student achievement, which is what we are all about. Probably everyone in this room and throughout the state of Minnesota would agree that a prime focus for education is to make sure that all of our children are advancing in their learning and reaching their maximum potential. It's all about eliminating the educational disparities that we are faced with throughout greater Minnesota, as well as in our urban centers and our metro and suburban schools. Focusing on educational best practices, of course, is another key component, with the bottom line being to position Minnesota to lead the way in preparing our students to succeed in a global economy. In fact, in the Willmar Public Schools this year, our theme is developing responsible world citizens to succeed in a global economy. We're concerned about the information age that our children are growing up in, but are we preparing them adequately to be successful and productive? On the next slide, you'll note that now in Minnesota, there are a number of factors to keep in mind. First of all, the achievement gaps that exist between student groups, and recognizing that in Minnesota, these gaps, when we disaggregate our groups and disaggregate the data, represent some of the largest gaps in the U.S. But the United States also has significant achievement gaps when we look at the international scene. Looking at the Program for International Student Assessment, we see that amongst the developed nations, 15-year-olds in the United States rank 24th out of 29 in math, 24th out of 29 in problem solving, and 15th out of 29 in reading. These are issues we want to get our arms around and tackle. We know that more high school students are taking lower-level math classes, yet fewer are taking those upper-level math classes that we know are important when we think about the information age and preparing for the global economy. Surveys that have been done also indicate that parents and students alike think that they're taking enough math. They think that the math that they're taking, even though not necessarily at the higher level, is adequately preparing them for this world that they are going to be hopefully thriving in. 20 to 33% increase in scientific and technical occupations are actually projected for Minnesota in the next 10 years. Take a look at those next several bullet points and understand how critical the call to action is. When we think about the shortage of doctors and RNs, right now Minnesota is number one in the nation for pharmacist shortages. And then you note that Minnesota produces only half of the needed clinical laboratory scientists each year. Again, this frames the whole concept of making sure we're preparing our students with an adequate education that will allow them to soar. We know that college graduates make much more than someone who does not graduate from college, or certainly more than a high school dropout. And we also know that we're living in an age where the population is graying. We have many people that will be retiring from the workforce, and the need for talented young people to take their places is absolutely essential if we're going to continue to prosper as a state and as a nation. So based on that, are we ready to make Minnesota's promise? The first trait that we identified in the superintendent symposium is the fact that there are many academic roads, but all must be rigorous and all must lead to higher education. The low-skilled jobs that once could provide a sufficient livelihood for families are no longer available. All of us are aware of that. It's very rare to find a job where using your back is going to make the kind of living that you need to thrive in today's society. All students, we recognize, need to be on a challenging path. That can be through a technical program, an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree. But every student needs to be prepared for post-secondary opportunities. Every student needs academic rigor, not just some of the students that are in our AP classes or our IB classes, but every student needs rigor in their high school curriculum. We also feel that it's important to be motivating all of our students to take advantage of these precious learning years. When we think about our pre-K through 12 learning experience and then think about post-secondary on top of it, are we sending the right message as a society, as a state, to value the learning years and to make sure that we're getting the most out of them? Learning can be a full-time job for students and young people if they take this seriously. It's also important to make sure that for our families in Minnesota that have not experienced that education can add value to their lives, that we help them as a state understand how critical education is to adding value, adding depth to the lives of children so that they can compete and be successful in the global economy. Moving on to our next trait and setting the stage, we recognize that currently, about 11% of Minnesota's young children under 6 live below the poverty line. And the poverty rate, as you are aware, doubles for young children of color. Look at the number of babies that are born in the United States a day, 2,341, to mothers who are not high school graduates. What does that do when we think about recognizing that education adds value to one's life? The U.S. is last among 16 industrialized countries in the proportion of children living in poverty after all income supports are counted. And much of this data and more can be found from the work of the Children's Defense Fund, and I would challenge you to look at that. It's very compelling as a part of our call to action. So based on that, are we ready to make Minnesota's promise? And you'll note the second trait, and that centers around the fact that educational investment starts early and must start early. I hope many of you have had an opportunity to hear Art Rolnick and others who talk about the return on investment when we invest in early childhood initiatives. The investment in early care and education produces a 16% rate of return for every dollar that is spent in this arena. We're talking about universal access to high-quality pre-kindergarten programs, but also understanding the value that can be found in an all-day, everyday kindergarten setting for all of the students in the state of Minnesota. The bottom line is that economical and educational arguments for investing early are very prominent, and we encourage everyone in the state of Minnesota to reflect on that value-added component of our educational system. Let's move on to the next trait. In setting the stage, we want to recognize the fact that only 33% of high school freshmen do all three of these things. They take challenging classes, they're also proficient readers, and they graduate with a diploma in 4 years. Only 33%. Our work is cut out for us, as we all know. I've mentioned, and you know this, we live in an information age with school based on an agrarian calendar. Minnesota's average number of school days is only 172, and that lags in comparison to many states, certainly in the nation. But look at the next bullet point when we look how we stack up around the world. 190 in England, in Japan and Australia, 210, and in China, 230. Roger mentioned about having the opportunity to be a part of an educational trip to China last year. I had the privilege of being a part of the Minnesota Trade Mission trip to China with Governor Pawlenty last November. It was absolutely eye-opening, life-altering in many ways as an educator. So based on what we know about what's happening around the world and in our state, are we ready to make Minnesota's promise? The third component, the third trait, is that learning takes as much time as it takes. As a group of superintendents and others who have joined us in this conversation, we feel that we need to align the time needed for learning with individual students' learning needs instead of working within a box. We know how important after-school programs are for extending learning time, valuable learning time, for many of our young people. But along with providing those opportunities, we know that we have to remove barriers such as those found in transportation for some of our children not being able to access these programs because of those roadblocks. We're talking about expanding and restructuring the school year. We're also talking about establishing a minimum number of school days and a minimum number of instructional hours. In other words, taking this to the next level. Our Superintendents Association, the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, last year began launching the concept of adding to the time that we devote to educational endeavors, and we're continuing to advance that not only as an association but through this work as well. Moving on, when we reflect on sort of the state of the state, we know that we have exemplary mentoring programs for teachers. They exist throughout our state. We know that teacher learning communities are becoming much more commonplace as an integral way to help with staff development. Reading First has been a great example of a partnership between schools and universities for taking us again to the next level with best practices when it comes to teaching reading. There are online staff development courses like TeachScape that are available currently in the state of Minnesota. We're using that in Wilmer after finishing up with the Reading First grant. Many districts are doing that. We know that exists. We know that QComp becomes an embedded staff development approach that some districts are taking advantage of to sort of expand their staff development opportunities. But based on some things that are happening in some parts of the state, we ask the question again, are we ready to make Minnesota's promise? The fourth trait is that great educators have great support. That's an essential component in our comprehensive and coherent vision for education in the state. Research shows that the quality of a student's teacher has the greatest effect on student learning. And that could be a topic in and of itself for a discussion with you someday. Mm-hmm. We know how critical it is to recruit, develop, support, and motivate world-class educators that have a passion for education and want to stay with the profession. We know how important it is to advance the desirability of the teaching profession in order to attract the brightest and the best. And we ask the question, what are we doing as a society to promote and propel the profession of teacher? Because we do need the brightest and the best in the state. We know it's all about implementing world-class leadership development programs for our principals, who are the instructional leaders at our educational learning sites. The University of Minnesota is working with the Department of Education and others on the NISL program, which is, I think, going to be one of those great prototypes for principal development that can help in advancing student achievement through our educators in our classrooms in Minnesota. Moving on, we all have been hearing about how critical it is to have rigor and relevance in our classrooms, and also to make sure that we're establishing relationships with our students, because it's when students find their meaningful niche in a school that they start to get more out of their educational experience. Many districts across the state of Minnesota are using growth models for assessing student achievement. I'm sure you've heard about the Northwest Evaluation Assessment, the NWEA, which has certainly found a prominent place in Minnesota schools to track learning progress from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. And if you're not familiar with NWEA, those of us as educators would love to help you understand how that's a value-added component in looking at data today. So are we ready to make Minnesota's promise, knowing what we have currently, but also based on what we think is needed? And the fifth trait designates the fact that data and research inform teaching and improve learning every day, and it needs to have that prominent role if we're going to continue to be a world-class education state. In order for this fifth trait to be realized, we know that we must enlist data to determine the means to achieve our learning goals. And I think many districts across the state of Minnesota are doing a great job with this. Are we as a state embracing the fact that data should drive our decision-making in all aspects of the educational operation. We know how critical it is to implement strategies and produce real results, and to stop doing things that do not produce these kinds of results. It's hard as educators to let go of favorite practices or favorite things that we have sort of grown up with in the profession. But we know that data can help us to make those decisions. We know how critical it is to focus on the growth in student achievement that demonstrates the progress of students. And that's what a growth model does. We're wanting every student to grow during the time that we have them each and every year. And in fact, our superintendent made quite a leap here and agreed, and this took us hours to actually flesh out, that if we have students for 1 year's worth of learning, sustained learning time, without the mobility that becomes a real issue and a roadblock to learning, that we can guarantee at least a year's worth of growth and achievement. It's a very dramatic statement. We're committed to that, and we think that that could be a part of any vision, comprehensive vision for the state of Minnesota. Moving on, currently there's a missing piece when it comes to funding education. When we think about the missing piece, we know that making sure that dollars are available to meet the standards can be an issue. Minnesota has the fifth highest funding gap between revenues available per student in the highest and the lowest poverty districts within state. This is actually from 2001-2002. It's the most recent data we could get our hands on, actually from Education Vital Signs in 2005. It's an eye-opening statistic. Let's talk about funding and ask the question, are we ready to make Minnesota's promise? The sixth trait is that we feel funding needs to be predictable and sufficient to produce world-class performance. I know you've had an opportunity to hear about the PS Minnesota funding study. If you need more details on that, we have people that can provide you with the nuts and bolts of a very comprehensive funding study that has just been completed. As superintendents, we feel it's critical to determine adequate funding for all students so that they can accomplish the essential standards that we have mapped out for them. It's all about identifying resources that will be available for a reasonable period of time. If we're going to make long-range plans, if we're going to carry out a strategic vision for education in the state of Minnesota, we need to know what kind of funding is in place for 5 or 6 years so that we can carry out the goals and the strategies that would comprise this comprehensive vision. It's all about securing the funding that's determined necessary rather than allocating funds based on what might be available, which is the current system that we're working under. And that's a tremendous leap in the way we would do business collectively in the state of Minnesota. Currently in the state, the number and percentage of students with special needs are growing in most Minnesota districts. Though progress has been made, there are significant achievement gaps. And again, as we disaggregate state test data, those gaps are very, very apparent. We know that there are many mandates to provide service, and these mandates are good. I think all of us in public education are so proud of the special needs programs that we have in place and what they are accomplishing. But we also know that paperwork and efficiency can become areas of concern. The federal government, as you're aware, is paying less than half of their 40% share of funding for special education. And in Minnesota with prorations, we're even falling behind the Minnesota share. And that, again, is a topic for another day. But based on thinking about special needs, and this is not only special education, this is any student with a special need, are we ready to make Minnesota's promise? The seventh trait is that services for students with special needs should emphasize the desired outcomes as opposed to the processes. It's all about, in our estimation, replacing some of the mandated approaches by identifying the outcomes and then allowing our talented professionals to select the most promising practices and the most promising services that they can devise for our children. It As I mentioned, we're very proud of the expertise that our teachers bring to the table in serving all of the students with special needs. And this applies to our second language learners. It applies to students that have disabilities and health factors that impact their learning. So it's a comprehensive look that we're taking when it comes to trait 7. Let's move on to our last trait. We set the stage by recognizing that relationships lead to economic partnerships. We found that out in China. It's a basic premise for any of our businesses that are expanding to any of the countries around the world, that before you can develop a partnership, that relationship needs to be established. So are we preparing our students to be able to develop those kinds of relationships with people around the world? We also know that more Americans are needed to learn other languages that are fast becoming vital to our own U.S. security. And these are languages such as Arabic, Chinese, Russian, Farsi, Hindi. We're learning more and more about how critical these strategic languages are for the health and safety of our nation. As Roger mentioned, more people in China are studying English today than there are people who speak English in the U.S. today. It's just a profound fact. And then take that to the next level. For every engineering graduate in the U.S., there are 12 in China and 15 in India. This is a call to action when we talk about preparing our students to be successful in a global economy. I'm proud to say that last week we started Mandarin Chinese in the Loomer Public Schools due to a federal grant that we were awarded. We have 40 students that changed their schedules during the fall term to get ready for this opportunity. Many districts across the state of Minnesota are taking on the engineering factor by taking a look at Project Lead the Way to implement pre-engineering courses of study at the junior high and the senior high level. Keeping all of this in mind, are we ready to make Minnesota's promise? The eighth trait is global citizenship is a core academic subject. This is all about not only studying languages, but emphasizing that knowledge and understanding of international affairs, world history, geography, global economics, and world languages are critical. It's about emphasizing basic fluency in a language other than English and making that a priority in our state. And of course, as educators, we're all about advancing cultural, racial, and linguistic diversity as an asset not only to productivity, but to peace around the world. So those are our eight traits. I'd like to close by referencing Thomas Friedman's book, The World is Flat, and you've, I'm sure, heard that in from many people who have testified before you over the last year or two. But in Thomas Friedman's book, and if you're my age, you can actually remember sitting around the supper table and hearing your parents say, clean up your plate, there are children starving in China, and we cleaned up our plate. I mean, that was just taken very literally. Today, as Thomas Friedman points out, parents are telling children to study hard because there are children in China starving for their jobs. It's a part of our wake-up call. It's a part of our call to action in Minnesota. So what are our next steps? Roger alluded to some of this, but obviously we're looking at focusing on a long-term vision or a strategic plan for education in the state of Minnesota. It's really about creating a roadmap that has a common destination for us as a state. It's all about positioning Minnesota for investing in future prosperity found in the young people that are in the schools across the state of Minnesota today, whether that's in preschool, K through 12, or post-secondary. They are our students. They're a part of this plan that we're promoting. It's building on the collective assets that we all bring to the table. It's relying not only on educational entities, but all of the other essential components of our communities that help in providing a comprehensive educational experience for our kids. So we would like to suggest that it's time to develop a promise that our children know they can count on all of us to keep. And we hope that you will join the superintendents in the state of Minnesota, post-secondary as represented through the University of Minnesota and MinSCU, and many other entities in making Minnesota's promise to our children.
Thank you, Superintendent Leadham, for a very concise and efficient and also provocative presentation. I believe we're going to hear from Mr. Pakel next, and then we'll open it up for questions.
I'll be brief because we're ready to get into some conversation. Let me just say, first of all, I apologize for jumping up. When you are a single parent and the cell phone rings, you got to go. And so I apologize to Kathy and everybody, and everything's fine. Let me just, I'm a product of Minnesota.
Mr. Pakel, I apologize for interrupting, but we have to have you state your name for
our record. I'm sorry. For our record. Kent Pakel. Consortium for Postsecondary Academic Success, University of Minnesota. I'll just add a bit of perspective on our state's most vulnerable students, our students who are facing the greatest educational challenges. And let me just kind of introduce that by prefacing the fact that I'm a student who grew up in St. Paul, in the Lexington-Hamlin Summit University, however we draw the lines, neighborhood, for whom public education in our state worked. Went to the continuum in St. Paul schools and went as an undergraduate to Yale and Harvard. And I don't say that to be self-congratulatory, but to say, and I mean this, that in my generation, 20-plus years ago, public education was an extraordinary path upward for somebody who grew up in our state who necessarily wasn't on a path to that trajectory. And the critical component of Minnesota's promise is how can we do that for the students who are in a much higher stakes economy and society than I grew up in. And it was high stakes then. Let me just say that Charlie Kite, Kathy Leadham, and Roger Giroux, along with the superintendent that I worked for the past 7 years, Patricia Harvey, were deeply committed to our students, our state students who face the deepest and biggest challenges. And what I would suggest to you is that Minnesota's promise is basically saying our state, across our political divides, across our attention deficit disorder as public officials and policy types, which is inherent in what we do, has got to get on the same page, because the only way you prepare kids to succeed in a global economy and close the achievement gap is by sticking to a plan, and sticking to it over time and through changes in leadership and in organizational structures. And that is our plea, and that has been my privilege to work with these 27 system leaders as they came together across rural, urban, and suburban divides to say, we've got to be on the same page and we've got to stick to the agenda. So what about our state's most vulnerable students? You know that we face one of the largest achievement gaps in the country. Let me just put it on the line. African-American students in Mississippi outscore African-American students in Minnesota on the National Assessment of Educational Progress. We have a student population that faces extraordinary educational and social challenges. Many of you probably noticed that African-American home ownership in the United States, despite the fact that Minnesota is number one overall, African-American home ownership, and I'm focusing on that one population as a case study, is 45 out of 50. So we're number one overall and 45 out of 50 for that population. And yet, here's the kicker, our African-American population in Minnesota is the fastest growing African-American population in the country. That's the future. That's where we lie, across Grand Marais and Rochester and Minnesota and elsewhere. That is where we need to be investing. Now, why would a state policy framework like Minnesota's Promise matter to those folks? Here's what I've learned in the past 7 years in working with Pat Harvey and both on the state and national level. We are never going to ramp those students up if they are separate and apart. They must be part of a larger statewide fabric that speaks to all kids. They must be part of a larger system and agenda. If they are separate and apart, if they are pull out rather than pull in, if they're remediation rather than acceleration, we're not going to ramp them up. But if we embrace them and do that, we have that possibility. And that's what these superintendents have come together to say. And so the basic thesis I would suggest to you for our state students who are struggling the most is that the 8 traits that Kathy identified, which have been added to by the feedback we've gotten since October, to include parent and community involvement as a 9th trait, and as a 10th trait, student mental health and wellness, suggest that our state's most vulnerable students will benefit the most from those 7 traits. There's very interesting research that comes out, and there's a paper, Carlos, that I can certainly share with the committee if it's interested in, from some Cornell researchers that says, if you put in place high-quality interventions for all students, educational interventions, the students who are best prepared to succeed actually will benefit the most. And so, contrary to your expectations, the achievement gap will widen. so that the students who are most disadvantaged will increase, but the students who are better advantaged will increase more. And that certainly was the case that I saw over 7 years I was in St. Paul, where a third of the kids were proficient in reading and math where we came in 1999, and two-thirds were proficient in 2005. But the achievement gap didn't close because the white kids got better, too. Mm-hmm. What we need to do is also have, in each of the eight traits that Kathy Leadham outlined, and the two that we've added, family and community involvement and health and wellness, we have to have a targeted intervention as well. You have to have a strategy that says we're going to ramp up the kids who need it the most. So let me give you just a couple examples. In the first trait, every road is rigorous and they all lead to higher education. There's an extraordinary program that both St. Paul and Minneapolis have invested in called AVID, Advancement Via Individual Determination. It started 25 years ago with a school teacher in San Diego Public Schools. It's an elective course that ramps kids in the academic middle up to more rigorous academic courses. It teaches them everything from how you organize your time, how you take notes, where you sit in a class, and most importantly, how you understand more rigorous academic content. That's a pathway to ramp our kids in the middle up to higher standards and higher expectations. In the second strategy that Kathy outlined, learning starts early. We know from the research that targeted four-year-old programs for students with academic needs are very, very high impact. So focus on high-quality early pre-kindergarten programming for students who are behind is a powerful strategy for ramping them up to success. And finally, I would just, another example, the data informs decision-making every day. We know that we need to look at the data of these students, and if your students are two or more grade levels behind, and I'll just take an example from the upper grades where challenges are the greatest. There's a program that many of our districts, including many of our outstate greater Minnesota and suburban districts have invested in, Read 180. It ramps up students who are two or more grade levels behind who can't read at grade level as they hit the adolescent years, and they should be encountering stimulating, engaging academic content. And it's a mix of teacher-based instruction, technology, and peer learning. And it begins to ramp them up to be able to read on grade level. So that's an example of using data to say these kids are two or more grade levels behind. It's the wrong program if you're more than that behind because you aren't ready for it. And it's the wrong program if you're close and just a little behind. So my thesis here is that all of the strategies in Minnesota's Promise have relevance to our state's neediest students, but that implementing them for those students is also going to require a targeted strategy to ramp them up. But they don't need a different strategy. They need to be part of the whole state fabric, because if they're not, it will be separate and apart, and it will be remediation rather than acceleration, and that's what they need and will get us the results that we hope for them.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pacow, and thank you all. For, again, very concise and provocative and very broad scoping presentation. I'd like to open this up everyone's jumping on board. That's terrific. So we'll start Representative Greiling, Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and testifiers. I have two questions. The first one is, could you comment on the governor's plan for the three R's that substituted your relationships with results? And then two, of course, music to my ears, tell me more about your number 10, the mental health and wellness component.
Superintendent Drew.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative Greiling. I'm not sure that I've had a chance to really go through all of the governor's speech or his budget. And you can make an argument for any one of the R's you want. Nevertheless, rigor is going to be a part of that, and results are going to be a part of that, and relationships are going to be a vehicle we're going to need to have in order to make it work. I don't know that you can separate the two. There's a piece in here about the data management, information management. A lot of the discussions, a lot of the debates go by the wayside if you're stuck with data. And one of the benefits of using information and data to get into the discussion of the merits of the words is to see what it is we're talking about in terms of outcomes and numbers. The three R's are tied to some other indicators of success and funding, and that's a whole other discussion that needs some time to get into. that we probably ought to have. But I'm not sure that the variance is really there. It'll depend on what we're actually talking about in the substance, what we want the children to do in those schools.
Representative Graham? I think there was a second part to your question. Mr. Kite.
Charlie Kite. I'm going to defer to Kent Patel to just share our next couple of steps that we're working on, that it's going to address the health and wellness issue, and then how we're going to try to move these traits to more of an action agenda. So, Kent, would you maybe share those two next steps that we're plotting on?
Sure. On April 24th, at the Ties Building, Kent Patel, in Roseville, we will be holding the Minnesota's Promise Summit, where we're going to bring as diverse a group of folks from across the state. And to the extent that those of you who are from greater Minnesota can help us do that, I would be grateful for that. To delve down in these 10 traits, the 8 you heard about from Kathy, plus family and community involvement and student mental health and physical wellness, to produce a final template. A final report. Now, it could sit on the shelf and not move things forward, or it could become a checklist against which we all measure our efforts to improve education in Minnesota, which is to say, if we do something with early childhood, then we look at data-driven decision-making and say, that's next. So that will be on April 24th. It's a partnership with the School Administrators Association and the university and a broad array of community organizations. I'll just say, in reference to Representative Greiling's point. I'm a former high school teacher, and I've taught in urban areas, and I've taught in well-off suburban areas. And I would just say the need to engage our students as people, as individuals, is so urgent, and it's so fluffy, it's so at risk of seeming like it's embracing the status quo, and it's nothing, but it's everything. When I started the work in St. Paul of high school reform, I thought rigor, relevance, and relationships, I thought relationships were the easiest. What I learned over 7 years is relationships were the hardest, which is to say every student is well known by a caring educator, and here's really the kicker, they have a peer group that supports academic success, that encourages academic success. That's where the relationships piece can't fall by the wayside. There is a rush across the country to get students who have been kept out of the rigorous academic path into advanced placement, international baccalaureate, other programming. That's the right rush, but the reality is it's not going to be right for all students, and for very few students is it going to be right if we don't engage them as people, as well-known young people. I, this is a far-flung discussion, and Charlie and I have talked about it often. I would submit that we have a crisis of adolescence in the country, in which we are facing a situation in which our teenagers live in cultures in which very little supports academic achievement. And that stretches not just beyond the inner city, but more broadly. But I think we can turn that around if we embrace the relationships piece, if we engage them as people. So I would encourage you to, I don't think the governor is wrong in saying high school as we've known it is obsolete, in that it doesn't prepare more than 20% of our kids for higher education, but I think the pathway toward a different kind of high school has to include the very interpersonal human connections between teachers and students themselves around relationships.
Representative Wardlaw and then Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm thinking of we need a quality teacher force, and I've seen too many science and math types leave for a better paying job. I've also seen some teachers probably shouldn't be there, and I'm thinking, how do you encourage your principals to have the courage to take a teacher aside and say, look, you're not doing the job, we're going to help you. We're going to do steps A, B, and C, but if you don't improve, I'm going to have to let you go. And I don't see that, Ralph, because I have seen, maybe I was one of them, I don't know, but I hope not, you know. At least one person like me. I have seen teachers teach math incorrectly. I've seen teachers belittle and berate teachers in the teacher lounge. I mean, berate students in the teacher lounge. And if you badmouth students in the lounge, I think that encourages an improper mindset, whether you realize it or not. So that's one area. My second question is, a teacher came to me and said, I think we're over-identifying special ed students. What do you think? And I said, well, it's probably better to be safe than sorry, but I don't know. And I have no clue. Is that an issue that you ever talk about? And also, the 70% in the classroom rule, I know my district, that's not a problem, but maybe in some of the out-state or greater Minnesota districts, maybe it is. And what are your thoughts on that?
Superintendent Leadham.
Chairman Mariani, Representative Wardlow, and members of the committee. I think to your first point and your first question, I would say it's essential that we have appropriate training for our principals. And that is starting to play out through this NISL program with the University of Minnesota. I think we've come a long way in equipping our principals to be instructional leaders so that when they are confronted with a situation where someone is not delivering up to par, they can go in there with strategies, help them develop an action plan that is truly meaningful. In my career as an educator and as an administrator, I have seen the change start to happen because we have many, many principals that understand educational pedagogy. They understand what it takes to appropriately impact student achievement. But that's a critical point. If they're instructional leaders, they need to be able to truly assist a struggling teacher in improving. So I think we're starting to see that change happen, but I couldn't agree more that we need to go the extra mile with staff development for teachers, because the research is showing that the leadership of the principal is a critical component in advancing student achievement.
Mr. Chairman?
Superintendent Giroux.
May I add a comment?
Yes, please.
We're doing, I think, a far better job of documenting what quality teaching actually constitutes and know it when we see it, because we've got some rubrics that describe it. I mean, get into the classroom more frequently now than we could before to observe that and give the feedback and talk about what teachers should or should not be doing. One of the problems mechanically we're running into is time. It takes time to make the observations. We don't quite have that time. It gets to be a continuum of issue. We're working on that. And as we get work on that, we're going to have a better handle on how to coach folks into improving their instruction and teaching. Last week, at Science Museum, prof from Michigan State, the head of the International Math Measurement Group, talked about math curriculum. And the reason I bring it up is because I didn't go along with everything he had to say. He was a little bit vitriolic about it, but consistency in the curriculum across courses, across classes, and across schools really helps in giving focus to what it is you expect the students to do and the teacher to do. And so that's really kind of the piece that's heading towards that common standard issue. And he had some graphs and things to say that the math curriculum can actually vary by classroom and teacher, and the door closes, you don't know, and that sort of thing. So I think that's coming into place, too. I understand what you're saying. I'm an optimist at this stage in my career. I'm an optimist. I think we're closer to it than ever, and we just have to keep moving toward getting that stuff done. There are challenges on time. There are challenges on money. There are challenges on resources, but it's there. It's moving time. It's aligning.
It seems to me that, and earlier we heard from one of you about the importance of using data to help drive change, so that I would imagine that sort of removes what could be a very stressful relationship between an instructor and an instructional leader, remove it from being a personal issue, and when it's really being driven as objectively as possible by test or by data outcomes in his or her classroom. Could any of you comment on the 70% question that Representative Wardlaw also asked?
I can't see what you said. I think that by the measures that they're using, no count of 74% or 73% in the classroom, when we just moved another percent up and a percent down administration, and I've got all the battle scars to prove it. Let me suggest to you that the data to define those kinds of things is really good. But it helps if the data precedes the standard, and we can find out what it is we're talking about when we say what's the impact of 70% in the classroom, and then we work through that and talk about the impact and the value. It may be that Anoka-Hennepin has too little
in some of the issues of supervision, oversight, and evaluation that's needed in order to ensure quality teaching. And that we've hit the mark and exceeded it and win a gold star, but not for exactly the right reason. And I really think that the idea of a cutoff of a percent is good, that working on the database that supports that cutoff is even better. And the more we understand about what it is we're talking about on distribution of funds, the better off we're going to be. You go to a district that's small, that's tight, doesn't have the resources and the access, and they're below the 70% mark, and you start taking some of the support services out of there, parents are going to come back and say, I don't care what the percentage is, what happened to my kid's service? And so, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Superintendent Leadham?
And I'll just also add that in Wilmer, we have 4,200 students, and we are above the 70% level as well. But I think the greater discussion needs to be around, again, coming up with what is it that we really want for our comprehensive educational approach, and then making sure that we're funding that. And that may vary a bit from district to district, but again, rather than just concentrating on a percentage and seeing how we're measuring up to that, I think more of our energy needs to go in looking at a comprehensive vision, coming up with the strategies that we know are essential to help all of our students, and then making sure that adequate funding is in place to carry out that plan.
Thank you. Representative Ward and then Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and testifiers. And thank you for a informative and hope-filled presentation. Very, very well done. I'm glad to see that my superintendent, one of my schools, Superintendent Wallstedt, is also participating. Just some comments and a question. We heard from the superintendent in Rochester last week how they restructured their school calendar in one of their buildings without adding any days and did it successfully, and I think Representative Welke verified that with me as well. I wanted to make that comment. And the other comment I wanted to make was we talked about QCOP and those initiatives that are there for staff as well as to make the student learning process better. The unfortunate thing is it's not available for everybody. And when we look at initiatives, I really believe that we need to make them available for all students and education community. My question relates to this. You talked about extending the school year, and you talked about minimum hours of instruction hours and minimum number of school days, you know, based on other China and other countries as well. Was there dialogue about, I just finished my career in 33 years of education, and I watched as the classroom size escalated significantly, thereby changing lots of direction within the individual classroom and thereby changing relationships a lot. And I really believe relationships is critical in education. Was there dialogue about maximum number of students in classrooms? 3K through 12, anyhow. Thank you.
Superintendent Leadham.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We did not spend a lot of time talking about class size because, again, I think what this boils down to is making sure that there's adequate funding to fund the accomplishment of the standards. And that could vary. There could be some classes where it's just fine to have 26 or 28. But we know that in other situations, we need to have 18 or 20 in order to accomplish the mission. So I think our preference, and while we didn't speak in detail about this, we would fall back to the idea of making sure that there's adequate funding so that our students can accomplish the standards and what it is that we've charted for them to accomplish. I couldn't agree with you more about the relationships piece, and that comes about often through the time and attention that teachers can give to students, but it also goes to that non-instructional time out in the halls, you know, the whole school experience where we have significant adults reaching out to young people. So it's a more comprehensive approach, again, that goes beyond class size, although that certainly contributes to the attention that one can give to children.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up. You mentioned, Superintendent Drew, that over in China you saw classroom sizes from 14 to 70, I think you said?
Yes.
Was there a difference? Lieutenant
Jerome.
Representative Ward. Yes, the reason is because those 1 to 70s were the elementary grades. There was a great deal of rote learning. Perfectly happy children. I have to tell you, marvelously engaged and absolutely delighted to be with us and with them. But teachers were teaching 2 classes out of the day, and the rest of the time they're in prep. But people power is plentiful and not expensive. And so there are different vehicles that you use in order to spread the staff and the kids, et cetera. So that's, you know, that's... But the 14-to-1, yeah, that's at the best and the brightest. That's where you're talking about the kid that eventually they're going to send over to Deerfield Academy to finish off the English so they can compete against us in math and science at Yale and Harvard. And there's not a lot of mistake. They're wearing jumpers that are uniform-type arrangements, and they're crisp as all hell and wonderful. I'll tell you, one of the really great joys of that, if I may, well, looking at the class of 15, 16-to-1, and the kid in the first row did not look Chinese. Well, it turned out he was from Michigan. And he was just joined his father to transfer, and he decided to finish a year in high school. And he found it very interesting, challenging in language, because he didn't know it. But the point is, yeah, it really has to do with the way they structure their learning. They, Mr. Chairman, they ask us, how do you introduce creativity into your instructional cortex? How do you do that? Because that's what you do well, and we don't. We need to learn that from you, and we're very clear on that. We've also had 2 delegations visiting our district from China in the last month, one on special education, talking to the passage of human rights laws within their nation to ensure addressing at least some of the special education needs of their students as a given right, and the other in vocational technical education, saying that this is a population where we need to do more, and we want to look and see what it is you're doing with technical implications. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Fascinating. Thank you. Representative Slawick and then Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I just have a comment and then a question. One, I applaud your vision and coming up with the 8 traits plus 2, plus where a vision for where we're going to go. I often think here at the legislature we should do something like that so we knew where we were going and we could build towards it. But it's a little bit like asking people that are in the middle of a fire, we want water, and we're getting the vision. And so it's frustrating for us because we're looking at these large class sizes and the unstable funding and the declining enrollment. And, you know, I stood in a high school gym, my son's high school gym, waiting for my turn to talk to the teachers. And then we got up there, they weren't sure who he was or which hour he was in. And they had to try to all figure that out. And you think, what are we doing? The relationships aren't there. So if you took your vision... And, you know, we're kind of looking for answers on a 2-year basis or a 1-year basis. What one thing do you think we should do this year to help our schools?
Mr. Pickell.
Thank you for the promotion, Mr. Chairman. Let me give you some water. This legislature has supported the Minnesota Principals Academy, which began with some legislation from Senator Steve Kelly, and that is now training 48 school leaders from across the state in a research-based curriculum that is about creating high-performing schools. I'm pleased to say that the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, along with the Minnesota Elementary School Principals Association, the Minnesota Secondary School Principals Association, and the Minnesota Department of Education and Commissioner Segrin have been strong supporters. We have 48 leaders going through a powerful curriculum that is about not just personalizing schools, but engaging them in research-based curriculum. And Representative Greiling joined us for a session recently, and she had a great dialogue with these leaders. With giving a plug for the hope that this committee will want to engage some of those folks in this discussion who have been strongly supported by their superintendents, let me just give you the list of places that are engaged in that. This is about Minnesota coming together. It has Owatonna, Columbia Heights, St. Paul, Minneapolis, Roseville, Cloquet, Montevideo, Waconia, Bloomington, Jackson, Maple Grove, Little Canada, Blaine, Richfield, Duluth, Dassel, Pine Island, Roseville, New Brighton, Hopkins, Wilmer, Gaylord, Orono, Forest Lake, Burnsville, Champlin, Ely, Pine Island, Rosemont, Plymouth, Moorhead, Eagan, Woodbury, and several others. And so this is a very tangible opportunity. The legislation, as I've learned in the language, has tails, but we need an appropriation to support the continuing progress of the Principals Academy. We're coordinating it at the University of Minnesota through the Consortium for Postsecondary Academic Success, and this is about helping school leaders create high-performing schools that I think would have a different experience than you had in the school gym the other day, I hope. So,
I think we can squeeze in a very quick question, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For Superintendent Leedon, I'm curious, in China, how are the educators there perceived? What is their status in their society and how are they recruited, how are they paid, and so forth.
Superintendent Leadham.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. While I'm certainly not an expert in that regard, my experience and the experience of the colleagues that I traveled with certainly found that the teachers were held in high regard, as were the administrators. One of the things that struck us very dramatically is the fact that with China being a one-child-only family, we, in our interaction with the students, and for all of our tours, one student was assigned to be our individual guide. So we really did have a chance to visit with them. But they accept a tremendous responsibility for not letting their families down. They know that their parents are pinning all of their hopes on what they will do. So that, I think, is a part of the equation. There's a value for education. And that is represented in our work that we did through Minnesota's Promise. How do we as a society really value these learning years? And that means everyone is speaking that language about taking the learning years seriously. We have so much to offer, but what are we competing with? And I think that's where the state's resolve needs to come together through all of us in saying, you know, we're going to turn the tide here. The respect for educators, very, very great. Regarding their salary, I don't have any background on that. I do recall meeting in the hall one gentleman from Canada. He was there teaching English. They're very open to having people from the United States be there to help with their English instruction, very welcoming in that regard. And there are a couple of great partnerships already happening in the state of Minnesota, and we're hoping to forge more of those, obviously.
Members, I apologize. We're just about out of time. This has been a great discussion. I want to thank Mr. Kite, Dr. Giroux, Superintendent Leadham, Mr. Pickell, for generating a provocative discussion with us today. I hope that part of what happened today will also provide us with some guidance as we begin to immerse ourselves and deconstruct the governor's proposal. It seems to me that a number of elements that you spoke about are present within the governor's proposal, and I suspect you had some influence in that development. Mr. Kite, just a few quick seconds to wrap us up here.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'd just like to conclude by saying thank you to all of you for giving us a chance to present our ideas. I did bring along 10 of the complete papers, so if anybody's looking for bedtime reading tonight, they're here for you to pick up. But again, thank you very much for being willing to hear us.
Thank you all. With that, the meeting is adjourned.